9 and 30 seconds.
Good morning, friends. It's Friday with Jim here at Coast Community Radio. I'm your host, Jim Wilkins. Happy to be here. This show was originated by Lisa Smith many years ago, and we thank Lisa for that. And if she's listening, hi, Lisa. The show is produced by Kathleen Morgain, and our engineer, fortunately, is with us, Mr. Terry Wilson. Terry, thanks for being here. And I'm really proud and happy to have as our guest today Keith Clark, who's the concert master and one of the actual founders of the Astoria Music Festival. This is the last weekend of the music festival winding down, and I really appreciate you joining us.
Thank you, Jim. It's so nice to be here.
I'd like to start out, tell me a little bit about your history and how did you end up doing what you're doing?
Well, I have been conducting, I think since I was a teenager.
Wow.
I grew up with music. Studied several instruments. I grew up on a farm in Illinois, and my father had turned our big barn. It was a big Civil War era farm with a huge barn with a big loft. We weren't a farming family, so we could either play basketball up in the loft, which my brothers and I did, or my dad turned it into a theater, which kind of disappointed us basketball players. But we had the good fortune then of having a theater in our backyard, lots of music and plays, piano. I studied piano was my first instrument, and then I went on to study viola. I moved west, went to UCLA, and got 3 degrees there, and finished my PhD. During my time in Los Angeles, I lucked out and became the assistant to two very prominent conductors, Zubin Mehta being one of them. He sent me to Vienna to study with his teacher, and what was intended to be just a one-year Fulbright year in Europe turned into about 10 years, and I lived and worked there. My wife is Viennese, and we had a wonderful time living in Vienna and in London. And then we moved back to California to start an orchestra in Orange County, California, which became the Pacific Symphony. It's one of the large, it's the third largest orchestra in California and one of the fastest growing orchestra in the country. And since then, I've been conducting, I have positions in Salzburg, Austria, and 2 positions in Russia now. And so I travel quite a bit. But 13 years ago, I moved to Oregon to teach university for a short time and discovered Astoria. I and 3 colleagues got the idea to start a music festival as part of the effort to restore the Liberty Theater, which back then was pretty needy. And with the help of Steve Forrester, Marge Bloomfield, community leaders who had the foresight to realize this was a fabulous potential to restore a beautiful historic theater, and for my purposes, a theater that has the acoustics to rival just about any place in the world. And that was what attracted me, and we've been at it ever since.
Yeah, I was curious about that. The acoustics, could you characterize? I've heard this before, that the acoustics at that venue are remarkable. Can you characterize that in any way for our listeners?
Theater has the advantage of, has several advantages. First, it's relatively small. It's the size of a typical European opera house in a typical middle-size German city, and each city has an opera house. And a thriving musical life, cultural life, rotates around their theaters. They're about this size. The older ones are very similar in construction. They have a balcony, as this one does. The seats are all close to the stage, so you can actually see human beings on the stage and instead of little ants that you see if you're up in the third balcony of the Metropolitan Opera. It is made of all natural materials. I don't think there's one shard of fiberglass in that entire building. Real plaster, real wood, and a lot of filigree, which is, I think, an important thing that marks the great halls in Europe, where I love to work, that these little niches and crannies and the chandelier up over the audience give the sound, which is just vibrating through the hall, gives some of that sound a place to hide for a millisecond or so. And then it emerges and enters into an overall sound that we perceive as sound of great depth.
So it's kind of a built-in reverb?
Yeah, it's sort of, exactly, yeah. And very resonant because of these natural materials. All of them are vibrating, just like a violin, or just like your guitar.
Mm-hmm.
The theater itself vibrates and produces its own, adds its own luster to the sound. So it's really great.
Now, over the years, I imagine that you've worked with some really pretty incredible musicians. I wonder if you could talk about a few of them. I'm particularly interested in really skilled musicians and their lifestyle.
Well, from the get-go, this has been a professional music festival.
Yes.
And has, fortunately, in my travels, I've made a lot of friends. And I've spent the last years in the Astoria Music Festival taking advantage of my friends and getting them to come to a place most have never heard of. And those on the East Coast or not very far east of us. When I mention the Astoria Music Festival, they imagine that it is in Queens, New York.
Yeah.
But once they come here, they're hooked. And they meet the people in Astoria and they perform in this beautiful theater, and we have a great time together. So our roster of artists include a number of people from major symphony orchestras. Our orchestra is comprised of players from all over the country. We have members of the New York Philharmonic, the Los Angeles Philharmonic, big city orchestras, mixed with a good number of very fine players from Oregon, from the Oregon Symphony and Portland Opera. Our soloists, we are very fortunate in having a roster of singers. We particularly emphasize our work in opera, and virtually all of our singers have had stellar careers at the Metropolitan Opera, great opera houses in Europe, and our instrumental soloists include, well, some of the heroes in Astoria include the cellist Sergei Antonov, who was the youngest cellist to win the Tchaikovsky International Competition in Moscow, which is probably the most important musical competition in the world, and he won it when he was just a kid, which is pretty phenomenal. He's our rock star. He has established a place for himself in the hearts and ears of the Astoria people, and we're fortunate for that. And our other soloists are all of that nature. We're very fortunate to have Carrie Lewis, the pianist with a very rich professional career, be in charge of all of our chamber music activities, which combine these great players into smaller groups, and it's a great opportunity to hear these really fine artists up close and as individuals, not just
as... Do you still play the viola?
Oh, I'm a terrible viola player.
Oh, okay. Well, what I was getting at with my original question, Sergei is a good example. Does he practice every day? I mean, does he spend several hours a day... Oh. On his instrument, or is it, has he reached the point where he's mastered it and doesn't need to spend that much time with
it? Oh, that it were true that you reach a point where you don't have to practice anymore.
Right.
That is, I don't think that ever arrives in a musician's life. Someone such as Sergei or any of our instrumental soloists probably started practicing when they were six. and or earlier, sooner. Sergei has a 5-year-old son who's already practicing the cello. And I start at that very, very early age and never stop and generally practice. It's not unusual for a concert soloist to practice 6-8 hours a day.
Yeah.
Every day.
Right.
Of their lives.
Yep. That's kind of what I was asking about. Now, at the Astoria Music Festival, we brought Steinway piano here. How is that piano holding up?
That piano is becoming a remarkable instrument. As any new, you know, you get a new car, you've got to break it in. And it takes a while to do that. And you have to do a lot of adjusting, to, especially if you buy a Ferrari, which is what the Steinway is. It's a very, very high-performance vehicle, instrument. And takes constant tweaking and modifying a little bit and tuning up all of the time and making small improvements. The last year, the piano, even though it's not old by Steinway life, I have a beautiful instrument at home. It's 100 years old, and it's actually starting to sound pretty good now after 100 years of constant playing. But so this one has a long life ahead of it. And but as any new thing, it's needed this constant maintenance. In this past year, a wonderful piano technician named Clark Forrester he took that whole piano apart and basically rebuilt the entire action, which would be like rebuilding the engine in your Ferrari, and put it all back together, and it is sounding great right now. Everyone is just, the players that perform on it are just in love with this instrument now.
What are some of the, who are some of the other instrumentalists that you've brought to town that you're particularly enamored of?
Well, as soloists,
yeah.
Our first soloist was Martin Chalifour, who is the concertmaster of the Los Angeles Philharmonic, one of the most respected violinists on the planet. Also a Tchaikovsky competition prize winner at one time. Our second soloist was Ilya Kazantsev, a prize-winning pianist from Russia, one of the members of the Hermitage Piano Trio, which includes Sergei, a violinist, Misha Kalin, and Ilya Kazantsev. That stellar trio, which each one of them is a highly recognized soloist, get them together, and it's the all-star team. So they have been in residence all throughout the music festival. We've heard them as soloists. We've heard them as a trio. We've heard them as playing as a trio with the symphony orchestra. So those guys really represent the cream of the crop in instrumental music.
Do they ever sit around and jam and like jazz musicians do? I mean, and kind of make it up as they go along? Is that part of what they can do?
I'm sure they can. Improvisation is not a big part of a classical musician's life, the traditional classical musician's life. Everybody is different. Some people are great jazz players. Some not. Some play Baroque music, which is far out of their general diet. But Sergei, in particular, he jammed this year with Israel Nebiker.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that.
Yeah, we try to have very broad taste. I love all kinds of music. So to me, I agree with that statement. I don't know, was it Duke Ellington or someone who said there are only two kinds of music, good music and bad music?
I think that was the Duke.
And I agree with that, and we try to present good music of all sorts. So this year we've had Israel Nebiker playing his Blind Pilot music. He's someone from this area who's enjoying a national, international reputation career right now. His very unique sort of singer-songwriter, folk-inspired pop music. We had Renaissance music, 16th century music. Music that's, 500 years old, played on instruments that would have been recognized 500 years ago, the very unique Renaissance instruments. So we presented that for, you know, there's some people for whom this is the greatest music. There are others for whom this was a brand new thing. And when they heard the sound of recorders and these ancient instruments, they fell in love with them.
It's hard to get all of those things in tune.
It is, but they did. So we try to, we have something for everybody. Kids' concerts, more popular music. And this, well, as an example, this weekend, our last weekend, tonight, our students, we have 25 vocal students from all over the country and an orchestra of outstanding players, are presenting the second of their two fully staged performances of Mozart's opera, The Magic Flute, which is extremely entertaining, spoken in English, sung in German, with supertitles, and it is a magical, well, it's a magic opera. There are a lot of very interesting things going on in it, and even made even more interesting by our stage director, Brian Stoffenbiel from San Francisco, who has staged this entire German opera in Astoria. So we have everything in it, from Lewis and Clark to pirates to even the bar pilots. So it's that's Friday night. On Saturday, we have a big organ concert in the afternoon in the Liberty Theater. Rogers Organ has installed a huge concert organ that's going to really raise the roof. Tomorrow night, there's a chamber music concert with Kerry Lewis playing the piano and the Enzo String Quartet, a internationally touring string quartet. And then Sunday at 5 o'clock, our grand finale, and it will be grand, is a the first Pacific Northwest performance of an opera called Maria Stuarda, which is merely a way of saying Mary Stuart or Mary Queen of Scots.
Right.
By the opera composer Donizetti, who wrote very, very beautiful music for singers, a style of music called bel canto that merely means, you know, all these fancy words are kind of intimidating, but this one merely means beautiful singing. It's a particular style of music where the singers are given an opportunity to really show their stuff, and they will, and we have singers with a lot of stuff. Angela Mead, one of the reigning sopranos in the world, is singing the role of Mary Stuart, Maria Stuart, Mary Queen of Scots. And her rival, the Queen Elizabeth, is Alexandra Desjardins, who is likewise a big international star. And the two, so hearing the two of them sing is together, as rivals, of course, Mary, Queen of Scots, and Queen Elizabeth had a great rivalry brought about by a quest for power, two queens, a religious controversy. Mary, Queen of Scots, was Roman Catholic, and Queen Elizabeth, of course, as the daughter of Henry VIII, was the newly emerging Protestant. So there's religious turmoil. They were cousins, so they were had an inner family turmoil, and Queen Elizabeth gets the better of her cousin, and Mary, Queen of Scots, of course, loses her head at the end. So, but I think the audience will lose its head, too, when they hear all of this great singing.
Well, I'd like to take just a minute to remind our listeners that it's Friday here at Coast Community Radio, and we're visiting with Keith Clark, who's a director and one of the founders of the Astoria Music Festival, which is winding up this weekend. I appreciate you being with us, Keith.
Oh, it's my joy to be here.
You know, we spoke a little bit earlier, kind of briefly, about jazz, and I know you like all kinds of music, but I'm wondering, jazz players in many ways are very, very skilled musicians.
Oh, absolutely.
As are the people that you work with. I wondered if you could compare and contrast the two disciplines.
Well, jazz players, as you say, are just as highly accomplished as anybody. You know, Dizzy Gillespie went to Juilliard,
mm-hmm.
and it's a it's a different approach to music in that most of the music that we classical musicians play is music that was written down mostly now by dead guys.
Yeah, yeah.
So we are interpreting, we're trying to get inside the head of someone that lived 200 years ago or 100 years ago.
It must be difficult.
Well, it takes a lot of study. For my particular job, there was a great English conductor, passed away recently, called Colin Davis. And when he was probably on the radio just like this, someone asked him, what does a conductor do? What's your main job?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't make any music. I have this baton that doesn't make a sound. I'm merely kind of the coach of the team, and the team is out there on the field playing. But his response was, the job of a conductor is to read. And that was a profound statement, because that is true. My job is to study as hours and hours a day. I'm not like Sergei, practicing 8 hours a day. I practice piano a little bit, a couple hours a day, but for my own edification.
Mm-hmm.
But the rest of the day, I am reading and studying scores and music and trying to understand what Beethoven really was all about. And that, all that reading, all that study, listening to other performers, eventually forms in my own mind my own approach to performing the Beethoven Fifth Symphony, which we just performed. We opened our festival this year with that great, great masterpiece. My approach to that, I'm sure, has changed over the years. I probably first conducted it 35, 40 years ago when I was a kid. And the more I learn, the more I study a piece like that, you can look at and analyze and ponder over, and every day you find something new.
Mm-hmm.
And so my job really is to do all this study, analyze the music, figure out what's important, try to bring that out, try to present that to the audience, try to present to the audience what I think Beethoven wanted us to hear. Now, a jazz musician, much more than we classical musicians, is also a composer.
Yes.
Because they are improvising on the spot. And whereas many composers will ponder days over, you know, whether it's going to be this note or that note, jazz musicians do it right there on the spot. They often will take a pre-existing song, but not always, and then present their own ideas of how to transform this pre-existing song into something new and show us other possibilities that exist within this music. Or they write their own music and then build upon that.
Well, you know, you talked just briefly about your discipline and what you do in your field of study, and it made me think from a jazz perspective of Duke Ellington, who I would think does very similar to what you do, but from a jazz perspective.
Sure. That style, especially you can't have a band like the Duke Ellington band and have everyone on the stage improvising. So the music that the band plays is just as written out as our symphonies. I mean, when we hand out Beethoven's Fifth Symphony to the musicians, the instrumental parts, and each musician has a different one, the flute has a different one than the oboe. Duke Ellington's band is exactly the same. When they hand out the music to the players, they expect the players to play
those notes
on the written page.
Yep.
But then there will be moments in the meantime where individuals are given the opportunity to give their own ideas about their improvisations, their ideas about what this song's all about. And that is not written down. We have the same thing in classical music.
That's what I was wondering. Describe that.
That in our first our first two concerts, Saturday and Sunday, the 13th and 14th of June, we played the Beethoven Violin Concerto with Martin Chalfour and the Tchaikovsky First Piano Concerto with Ilya Kazantsev. Each of those has a couple of moments, minutes, where the orchestra stops and there's no music written, and that gives the soloist the opportunity to play what we call a cadenza, mm-hmm. which is his chance to be a jazz musician, his chance to improvise and use the music that's come before as material to really show off technique, to just unbound by having to fit in with the orchestra. They're totally on his own. Huh. And this was always a hallmark of the performances by these great virtuosos, well, Beethoven being one of them.
Yeah.
And they were expected to make it up. Sometimes they made it up on the spot. Sometimes they, I'm sure, worked it out, practiced it, and came up with what they were going to do. Some composers wrote theirs down as an example of, okay, here's what I'd do,
mm-hmm.
but then left it up to the performer to say, well, you know, I'd rather do it my way. In the meantime, other soloists have written their own cadenzas that then became sort of traditional, such as the Beethoven Violin Concerto that we performed. There are probably hundreds of these probably available. And one what we performed, or Martin Chalfour performed, were cadenzas written by the great violinist Fritz Kreisler. And so he wasn't improvising, but he was playing someone else's improvisation.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the same idea. Their music is music. Good music, bad music, and we only do the good music.
Yeah, it reminds me of the way that early music was with the roving musicians that played for the feudal lords, and then that music gradually got codified and ended up being written down and became classical music.
Oh, sure, for hundreds of years.
Yeah, it's a matter of evolution.
For hundreds, for thousands of years, music wasn't written down.
Exactly.
And what the value of writing music down is that you can give it to somebody else and say, okay, here, play it.
Yeah.
And you can pass it around. And that's what makes music fun. Sometimes we make it up. Sometimes we play somebody else's.
You know, we've been having a really fascinating discussion with Keith Clark, music director at the Astoria Music Festival. Keith, I appreciate you being with us.
Oh,
I really enjoyed speaking with you.
Oh, great.
But I want to leave a couple of minutes for Terry Wilson, because Terry has some information to talk to us about our new fancy microphones that are state-of-the-art somehow. Terry, what are you doing?
Well, let's go back a little bit. I think we started broadcasting live on KCPB and broadcasting worldwide now in 07. And our microphones were strapped to the rails of the balcony with bungee cords. I'll never forget one concert. I kept hearing boom, boom, boom during the applause, you know. Or when people tapped their feet, it was a lady on the first row of the balcony who had a cast, and she couldn't slap, so she was banging her cast on the railing where my microphones were attached. Now let's go to 2015. I kept bragging about Jack Gable is a man who comes in for Keith, who records the concerts and that, and he's got these marvelous Russian microphones, and I've been bragging about those Russian microphones for 2 or 3 years. Somebody heard me, and they wrote a check, and we now have two Russian microphones hung permanently in the Liberty Theater, and we have another pair that we can move around. But they're superb instruments. They're like a fine Stradivarius violin.
Cool.
And so we're really tickled with that.
So, well, I've been visiting with not only Terry Wilson, but Keith Clark. Had to talk about those microphones, Keith. Thanks. Appreciate you being here. And I'd urge our listeners to stick around after the news for the always wonderful Albert Smith Show. Friday Folk with Albert. Albert has a really interesting taste in music, and he puts it on a good show every Friday. Otherwise, I'll see you next week. Goodbye. Thank you.